Welcome to a podcast from the EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcast or subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference. Participants include A. Michael Berman, Acting CIO at California State University Channel Islands, Sharon Collins, Project Manager at East Carolina University, and Tina Meyer, Director of the Server Administration at the Oklahoma State University. The session is entitled, Glimpses of Our IT Future, What's Green, Mobile, and Regulated All Over.
What's green, mobile, and regulated all over actually is a fairly succinct description of today's evolving IT environment. More than ever, we're finding that we're dealing with a new twist on Moore's Law these days. As technical capabilities continue to double regularly, energy, economic, and regulatory constraints on those capabilities are increasing exponentially as well. This year's committee has attempted to capture a glimpse of the collective future for IT professionals in higher education, anticipating not only the evolving technologies, but also ways to address the ever-evolving constraints placed on our ability to provide the technologies other institutions have come to expect. This morning's presentations, we'll have three this morning. First one will be on green computing, which is presented by Tina Meyer. Then we'll move to location-aware computing, presented by Michael Berman. And finally end up with virtual worlds in education presentation by Sharon Collins. Unfortunately, our two speakers that were working on the regulatory and compliance types of things were unable to join us at the conference this year, but their papers will be, the synopsis is in the EDUCAUSE Review paper that is coming out in the November-December issue of EDUCAUSE Review, and papers will be up on the website, so I invite you to go take a look at those there. We're also going to hold questions until the end of the presentation, and at that time we'd not only like questions, but we'd also like some suggestions on where the committee might go for next year's topics to take a look, get some ideas from all of you as to what's on your minds. What are those technologies that you'd like us to take a look at, some ideas that need to be researched. So without any further ado, I will turn this over to Tina Meyer.
My colleague John Moses and I took the green computing presentation, and so today I'd like to give you some information that we found from our research. 2 years ago, OSU started our green initiative when we began outgrowing our power and cooling needs in the data center. So I'd like to show you our extreme makeover. This is actually a picture of our data center during the construction of installing new power or cooling units there in the data center. So trust me, this picture kept me up a lot at night because every enclosure was enclosed in plastic, and they did the tubing to keep our data center going while the construction was going on. You know, one of the first questions is why go green? Your financial officers would say to save us money. That is one of the biggest reasons that, you know, we keep seeing in a lot of the research was the economics. Also, you can improve the environmental impact by using less resources on your campus. As a public institution, we are stewards for their money, so this shows our taxpayers that we are utilizing their funds in a very conservative method. And then also from a politics standpoint, state, local governments may be undertaking green initiatives, so that is another reason for going green. How to go green? I'd like to use the example at Oklahoma State as some of the background. Starting in 2007, we hired energy managers on the campus, and each energy manager was assigned several buildings on campus to work with the constituents on their power needs. If there were labs, they talked to us in the data center to understand how we would use the power when people would be in the buildings. And then in August of 2007, a policy was adopted by the university outlining, you know, being stewards of resources on campus and that it was everybody's job to consume or conserve power and other energy sources on campus. The president, all the executive team started a green campaign. We, you know, at the bottom of signature lines, you'll see, you know, please don't print or to save paper. We've got green at the bottom of several of the websites. So that was a big campaign that we had on our campus. As I mentioned, the energy managers on campus, they had tools in place in each building that did sensories on temperature and also if lights were left on. So that gave them the information needed to create the reports that are provided to the board and to the public at least every quarter. And this last report showed that for the overall OSU system, we saved $2.2 million in energy cost, which is, you know, over time, that is a quite a big savings. The other three items are things to look at. Workstations, you know, everybody's got one of those in the office. You know, how much will you save by turning them off? Computer labs, you know, we have IT manages 500 seats on campus. And so what we did is work with the energy managers on the most cost-effective way to keep those going, either by turning them off or putting them in sleep mode to conserve energy. And then lastly, looking at the data center on the power needs, the cooling, and starting to look at virtualization. For workstations, the information here, if you turn off your computer, you can save over 100 hours of energy if you have a 40-hour work week. So you think about the amount of energy that's used by leaving a workstation on, and this information was taken from Dell, that you could save about $75 per workstation by upgrading to a new model. The annual energy savings is about $37,000, which could, for us, help us change over a computer lab. Our data center, we did focus on upgrading our power and cooling to make it more efficient. Other resources utilize, like Gartner Group, Burton Group, some of the paid subscriptions. There are also some blogs out there that talk about power and cooling and how to set up a data center architecture. There was one recently out there about how Google's data centers are set up that was quite interesting. Some of the things we're also looking at are automating server shutdowns and then cooling on demand. If you were on the exhibit floor, you might have seen APC had their enclosure, which is part of the future of cooling needs, instead of going through the extensive remodel that we did. Virtualization, we undertook a major project at Oklahoma State. We have a 9-server virtual farm, and what we did is we looked at the servers that were setting at 10 to 30% utilization, and we looked at several tools to see which ones were the best candidates for virtualization. And what we did is we used we're using VMware, and we have the VMware tool, cost of ownership, and it was a 4-month return on investment on what we had made. And so these numbers are a 3-year payback. So as you can see, we're saving by virtualizing over 100 servers, we're saving over $250,000 in power and cooling, $800,000 on hardware, and $50,000 in network. So these are major savings that you can see for by virtualizing and help you with your green initiative on campus. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Michael Berman, who's going to talk about location awareness.
Good morning. I don't know about you, but I could have used a GPS to find the room this morning. Well, this is work that is based on research that I've been doing with Sue Lewis and Tony Conto. Unfortunately, neither of them could be here this year. And we're going to wrap up the white paper and get it online pretty quickly so that you'll be able to see what we found. But this is just a quick summary of some of what we were looking at. So location-aware systems sense the location of the user. They're normally portable systems. And then they change their behavior based on that location. And we're all familiar with GPS. That's a classic example of that. But the applications and the types of ways of sensing location go quite a bit beyond GPS. Location, there's a number of different ways that a system can determine its location, and four of the most common are listed here from the least precise to the most precise. So mobile phone triangulation measures the distance of the device from various cell towers, and using triangulation then determines the location. And that's accurate roughly to a building. If you had mobile phone triangulation, you could probably tell you're somewhere near the Orange County Convention Center. So it's not terribly precise, but it gives you a rough idea where you are. Wi-Fi triangulation is the same algorithm, but instead you're using Wi-Fi antennas. And because generally they're installed in a more dense manner and more and closer together and also indoors, they might be able to tell you which room you're in. So if you had Wi-Fi triangulation, it might be able to tell you a person carrying this device is in room 312 in the convention center. GPS we're familiar with, and GPS is very accurate. It's accurate down to a couple of meters under good conditions. But this would be an example of very poor conditions for GPS, because GPS doesn't work well inside buildings. If you're inside a big concrete enclosure like we are right now, GPS probably doesn't do you much good. So a lot of the interesting applications you might want to deploy really don't work with GPS. If you want to do a campus tour, if your campus is a real outdoors campus, it's fine. But if you want to take someone through a building, a library, something like that, GPS may not be an appropriate technology. The most emergent of these, the newest and the one that seems to have the least actual work going on so far, but that people are interested in, is using location based on radio frequency ID tags. And this can get you very precise location. You can tell what seat somebody's sitting in a room. The disadvantage is you need to deploy a lot of devices. You need to deploy a mesh of devices in order to determine the location. So it's not really cost-effective for a lot of applications, but it's very interesting and certainly something people are looking at going forward. Now, if you look back over the last 10 years, a lot of this work was done on standalone devices, PDAs with special hardware on them, laptops with special hardware, but really the future clearly is the mobile phone device type, device that virtually everyone's carrying, because it's ubiquitous, it's inexpensive, and so really that's where most of the action is right now. But again, it has limitations because it's usually based on some combination of the first three methods in order to determine the location of the user. Some of the applications that we found out there that are already being deployed, at least in a test mode on campus, Carnegie Mellon University has a people finder system or friend finder system. So students and others who opt for this system can determine the location of their friends, look at it real time on a map, see where people are. Of course, they can turn it on and off. So if they don't want to be found, but if you want your friends to be able to see where you are, something very attractive to the mindset of the millennials, they're deploying an experimental system to do that. Smart guide systems are systems that will take you through a space, give you a tour. So it's kind of like the tour you do through a museum, for example, except that instead of having to press buttons or hold a wand and go through it, and you can the system knows where you are, and so it can give you the information that's appropriate to your location. So some campuses have experimented with campus tours, for example, based on this type of technology. Security systems, there's at least one commercial system that we saw out there that is a sort of a automated escort system. So student walking alone at night has this application on their cell phone, and they press a button, and it signals security that the person is alone and they're concerned about their safety. They're moving across campus. And again, depending on what's in the cell phone and how good it is at determining the location, it will give campus security some information about the location of the student that may be more or less precise depending on the configuration and how the cell phone works. But all cell phones have some location. All modern cell phones have some location built into them. Even if you don't see it, it's there inside your cell phone by law for public safety reasons. Rich media systems are similar to smart guides, for example, but they'll use video and audio. It's been used for traffic management. You can use and build simulation games. And, of course, kind of going beyond the friend finder surveillance systems, if you have a reason to track where people are, you can do that. And that, of course, brings us to the concerns, one of which is that emerging technology is showing video in a presentation, apparently. Privacy, who has access to the information, if you're keeping detailed information about people's movements, obviously that's subject to abuse, stalking, just privacy invasion. A lot of this technology does not have strong security built into it. Wi-Fi, which was really people thinking of tracking packages and so forth. If you're tracking people through a hospital or something like that, you've got different set of security concerns. If you want to use it for building access or something like that, it's actually pretty easy to spoof. And of course, some people are concerned about electromagnetic radiation, and do you really want to carry active electronic devices very close to you? But most people, whatever they think, they're carrying cell phones anyway. So I'm going to see if I can show you a video here. This is part of a master's thesis by a student on our campus. It's actually a couple years old now, so some of the technology doesn't necessarily look that emergent. You can see pieces of what's in here on an iPhone or a BlackBerry now. But I like it because it shows an integration of the technology in a very interesting way as part of a product that this student designed. And you see, especially towards the end, an implementation of what's known as augmented reality. It's really combining rich media and location with a sophisticated use of the device. This was designed for specifically for children in the military, and they move around, their families move around a lot, they tend to become very isolated, and so this was a social network. It was designed to help them integrate into new communities.
Hi, yes, I worked on this with Kelvin Bentley and Anthony Conto, who weren't able to be here, and we're doing virtual worlds in education. What are the characteristics and usage? They're 3D computer-based simulated environments. I'm sure you've all heard of them by now. You have the ability to create an avatar. Some of us make them a replica of ourselves or what we think a younger self might look like. An imaginable alter ego, perhaps. You might take a persona of Halloween, Macbeth, something like that. It's educational, professional, and also military are using them for training. It's different for socialization. It helps in our course material and delivering courses in a different manner. Some say it's also good for gaming. We choose not to use that term because to us it's not a game. It's very serious in delivering our course content. It emulates experiences and objects from real life. And why are we looking at this? Our faculty are telling us in our different campuses that they're having to engage new learners in a new way. So we're looking at different technologies that can deliver that education. These individuals are driving the needs of the future, as you just saw in the video with cell phones. They're always on, as we know. They're easily bored. We must engage them, keep them active, and make them have a compelling user experience. And where do we go from here? What we're thinking of the future is one world in one space. So right now there are a lot of different virtual worlds. What we'd like to see is the emergence of all those worlds. And here are some of the virtual worlds we took a look at. Second Life, Google Lively, which came along, it's fairly new. Croquet, Wonderland, Active Worlds. And they're all great for learning new languages, for social networking tools, in that you create your avatar. Most of them have voice now. You can also do text. And it really keeps the students thinking as far as delivering material. This is East Carolina University's Second Life campus. We have kind of emulated our campus. Others choose to do it in a different manner, but these are actually some of the buildings that you would see if you walk on our campus. So some of the thought behind this was to make our distance learners feel like they were at ECU, or they said of being a virtual pirate. How we began was a concept, and we actually made this a reality in Second Life. We had an interior design instructor that wanted to work with us, and this is actually, they're put up images in Second Life, and these are actually designed by the students. So the top image you see is a handmade carving that the student has done. It's just out of styrofoam. We take a picture of it and we place it up in Second Life, and then the comments that you see down here, which didn't come out all that well, but they can actually comment on these. So they're getting peer-reviewed work in Second Life. They drop a note card, and the other avatars can go back and see what that note was and have a review of their work. Then they redo their work based on that comment or their instructor's comment. Mobility of people and learning. What you see on the other side is actually Wonderland, and that my avatar Scarlet was actually put in Wonderland. The avatars are just a little bit different, but just to show you where we want the technology to go, that I could move right from Second Life, which is one image, into the other one. The capabilities of virtual worlds: you can do presentations, you can have your PowerPoints, you can do movies inside there. We like to do site tours, so not just stay on our campus, but actually engage the students and send them perhaps on a scavenger hunt to other islands or to other places. And everything inside what we're doing right now is Second Life. That's just what our university chose. But there are other universities that are choosing other forms, such as Active Worlds. Simulations and role-playing are also fairly common. For instance, if you were teaching French, you could actually dress like someone of the French era. Today, for Halloween, there's a Macbeth Island, and they're actually opening that island up, and they're going to have the play, and there will be performers, avatar performers there. Discovery learning, you can do culture, like I said, by learning another language. It's also good for e-commerce business, and we're also using it for economic. Some of the new things coming out, recently Microsoft announced its Xbox 360 was actually going to have a virtual world, so it's going to be geared toward social chat, music, and video sharing, which it always has been, but now you're going to actually be able to engage in that medium in a different way. Sony has been doing this for quite a while, able to create an avatar and actually join in the games online and things like that, but they're taking that a step further now with PlayStation Home. One of them we looked at is Wonderland, because it is an open source toolkit and enables you to do a little bit more development, and it has the capability to have more users than some of them, like Second Life, for instance. In one space, you can only have about 45 to 50 avatars. So Wonderland's trying to explore that just a little bit further. Croquet can run on a local machine, so it just depends on what you want to do. Our College of Nursing actually does active worlds because they want to contain the server and contain the environment. Another aspect is being able to see this on your iPod and on your phone, iPhone. And I actually was at a restaurant the other day, and I heard someone talking, and I looked around, and they were actually showing it. And, of course, it was at EduCalls, but they were actually showing it on their phone. Another future could be Microsoft Surface, being able to move it around and move your avatar in a different manner. So these are just some of the things we want you to look at as you're thinking about virtual worlds. Would you want it on your watch? No, but could you? Maybe. And you know, it might be something like Star Trek. We've mentioned augmented reality. There's another hands-free navigation that's coming out by Linden Labs and another developer. We actually don't have to do things with a mouse. It's driven by a camera, and you can lean and do positions in a different way. So this is actually just an image of Second Life, and we wanted to leave you with something just a little bit more serene so that you could see some of the capabilities. And this was actually the Groove last night. If any of you were able to go, I'm going to show you just a quick movie if I can get over there. And what I want to show you here is just a depiction of what the worlds could be. This is Second Life, and this is what we had designed. What you're seeing behind there is a movie that was done by a faculty member. And then I had some students that wanted to show you how you jump from one world to the other. So this is actually now Wonderland, and this is New Media Consortium's area in Wonderland. That's actually a Wonderland avatar. So we're actually able to move from one world into the other. So we just kind of put this fun little video together for you so that you could see. And this is actually just another little Wonderland clip of three or four people meeting in Wonderland. We were using voice to talk. Just so you can see the differences in the graphics and some of the things going on. And a lot of them are really coming along now and coming up to speed with some of the others that have been here for a while. And this is actually Google's Lively. Some of the graphics and things, you know, that you can see here, again, are a little bit different than what you see in Second Life. The avatar is a little bit different. So just some of the quality and some of the features that you see. And, you know, and again, we see this as being all mobile for our distance learning students, and for them being able to come into a world where they can still meet with faculty, which we're hearing that they really are enjoying this. Been to several presentations this week where they say that this is something that's been put in place in their universities and that they are really enjoying. And again, we'll just leave you in the quiet of the garden. Thank you.
Okay, so we've had quite a range of explorations this morning, from the real to the virtual, and trying to find our way from one to the other in between there with some location assisted movement. So now we'd like to take a few minutes and open this up to questions, comments. We'd also like to hear a little bit about some suggestions that you might have for topics for the committee to explore over the coming year. I will remind you that, again, the paper is out in the EDUCAUSE review. The presentation will be available. We'll be uploading it to the EDUCAUSE website following conference. And full papers will be available through the committee's website at page at the EDUCAUSE website as well. So lots of additional information out there available to you. So questions, comments, thoughts? And I know this is at the end of the conference, but hopefully you've all had your coffee this morning. Where would people like to see this committee go for the next year? What are the kinds of things that you'd like to hear about over the next year? One of the things we've been thinking about is the possibility of doing a blog for this year to begin to get things out in a little more timely fashion, hit on a few more topics, give people a chance to comment back. Does this seem like something that would be useful to all of you out there? I'm seeing a few heads nodding. Come on, everybody wake up out there. Show of hands, anybody think this would be useful? Okay, good. Do we have a question? Yes, sir. The committee, in terms of participating in the committee itself as a member, the EDUCAUSE makes those decisions in terms of who is placed on the committee from year to year. But we do encourage people, we will encourage people to send in ideas to communicate with the committee as over the year. But we're in terms of actually, if you have ideas for things that we should be looking at in terms of corporate R&D types of things, do please get those to the committee, and we'd be happy to talk with you to see if we can include those over the year. So our incoming chair is going to be Sharon Collins this year. So
I was going to say I know there we do reference some industrial R&D work in our paper. One of the really interesting projects is out of Bristol, done by HP Labs in Bristol, England, for example. I don't think Mark Luker could speak to it. I think the normal model, although I think there's a lot of interest in innovation, but the normal model is this is an EDUCAUSE members committee, so all the people would be EDUCAUSE members. I don't believe there are very many regular EDUCAUSE members who are in industrial R&D labs. But on the other hand, I heard you saying two things. One had to do with the commercial interest, which is certainly something we try to research and something many of us have contacts in that area. But the other is internationalization, and I think the suggestion that having the committee have a broader international participation, I think is a great suggestion. And it has been definitely very U.S.-centric, and I'm sure that's something that the committee will take up and think about next year. Mark Luker is here, who has responsibility for EDUCAUSE, and Susan from... Yeah, and obviously the blog also is a way to broaden participation, be open to anyone, so be a chance for people to put that in. But I think having a more international committee is a really good suggestion.
Yeah, and that intersection between where traditional computing labs and the more informal computing spaces, the flexible computing spaces, that may be a transition that would be good to take a look at as well.
I do think something that's really emerging, too, is the question of kind of getting to what's underneath your point, too, just in general. It's one thing to take something you do and do it more efficiently, and there's a savings there. If you take something you used to do and stop doing it, that's probably an even bigger saving, depending on what you're offsetting to do instead. But I think it's a great point. We talked about in the committee looking back at some of the – next year will be the 10th anniversary, and we talked about looking back through some of the technologies and talking about possibly about which ones really have emerged and which ones have died off in that time, things that seemed emergent 10 years ago. Or I saw, like, maybe in the second year we talked about e-books, and that's still emerging, right?
Yeah, this is a separate group. We did take a look at the last couple of years of the Horizon Report right at the beginning when we were selecting topics. Several things that we looked at in order to draw on topics were the Horizon Reports, the Gartner Top 10. Also looking at there's all kinds of Top 10 lists out there for who thinks what's good about technologies. So we did try to incorporate some of those into our thinking in terms of pulling together ideas, but there's not a formal link between this committee and the Horizon group. So, yeah, good. Yeah, we are. There's a subtle implication in our name in terms of evolving technologies rather than emerging technologies. So this fits right in with how are we looking at those things that have, they're maybe not quite on the bleeding arterial blood edge out there, but things that maybe have actually begun to prove a little bit of worth or have gotten a fair amount of attention, and these kinds of things that we'd be working with students coming on campus would be a good topic. So, and we do welcome your comments, questions, additional suggestions for new things to look at. And thank you all very much for joining us this morning. We invite you to go back out and take a look at the full reports and the EDUCAUSE review paper. And join us next year to see what we've come up with at that point. So thank you all very much, and have a good rest of the conference.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Real Networks enables digital delivery of distance learning coursework, athletic events, and more to students anywhere. Information at realnetworks.com.